I'm Carmen LaSalle, and welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio and Part 2, Robert McChesney speaking at the Unitarian Universalist Church in San Francisco, California, on November 10, 2005. John Nichols will introduce Robert McChesney.
But I have the honor and the pleasure of inviting to the stage here with me and introducing to you the man who taught me, as a person who's worked in journalism for almost 30 years, since I was 11 years old, who taught me how to understand the media crisis in this country. A man who has taught many of us that we have to look beyond one Fox or one Limbaugh and understand a media system that would allow tragedy and farce. Please welcome my friend, my comrade, and I dare say my hero, Bob McChesney.
Thanks so much for coming out, John. Thanks for the kind words. You know, I think I ought to tell these folks, one of the pleasures of doing the work I do, writing books like this, is that John and I are best friends, and it gives me a chance to do stuff with my best friend. You can imagine what a privilege that is to share interests. But I don't know if you folks, this is a personal story, but it's a funny one. I'll tell how we met. So John moved to Madison in 1994, or late 94, and I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin, and John had just taken over as the editorial page editor of the daily newspaper in Madison, the Cap Times, the afternoon paper. Traditionally the most progressive daily newspaper in the country on its editorial page, at least, and John was brought in to take it over. And the local PBS station, very prominent in the state of Wisconsin, WHA, thought it'd be a great idea to have sort of a point counterpoint on the news as one of their segments in their weekly sort of 60 Minutes type show. And they thought, well, why don't we get the egghead professor, who sort of is known to be critical of the media, and then get sort of a hard-boiled, cynical journalist from the newsroom to duke it out on sort of the job the news media are doing. So they bring John and me, and we've never met before. I mean, I sort of knew John was a good guy because, like, the first article I read he published in the Cap Times was, like, an interview with Ralph Nader, I think, on the WTO. So I'm sort of thinking, this is going to be an interesting debate I'm going to have with this guy. He seems like a pretty good guy. So they bring us in, and the moderator starts asking me questions about the media, and I'm talking about how terrible it is and the crappy coverage they're doing and the corporate owners and how corrupt it is. And then they turned to John, expecting him to say, oh, professor, you moron, you don't know anything. And John would say, yeah, he's absolutely right, I agree, except it's even worse than he's saying. So that was our trial run, and we were never invited back. So we lost our chance to be television stars, but our friendship was born then, and this is our third book that we've had since our collaboration began on books. And I'm very proud of this book. I think it's the best thing we've written, certainly, together. And the reason I'm proud of it is that it crystallizes a lot of the research that I've done personally and that John and I have done together on media. And it also draws in the practical experience we've had in the last 3 or 4 years doing media activism ourselves with Free Press, the group I know a lot of you are familiar with, and with all the other groups like Media Alliance that we've worked with as well. And what we do in this book is what John has already talked about, is we provide, I think, a fairly detailed critique of how deplorable the press coverage has been of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and also of the presidential election of 2004, starting with the Democratic primaries, going right through to the election day and after the election, the situation in Ohio. And I'm very proud of that critique. But I'll be honest, there are other people who do critique too, and excellent critique of those issues. Norman Solomon has a wonderful new book out, War Made Easy, I urge you all to read. Danny Schechter, who was in the video that was shown for IWT, has a wonderful new book out that deals with these issues as well. There are lots of good books. We're not the only one, and I recommend you all look at those if you're interested. And they cover stuff we don't cover. I think we cover stuff no one else covers too. But I think what distinguishes our analysis in this book, and why I'm very proud of it, beyond providing a quality critique, is we do two things, I think, that are less likely to be found. One is, I think we provide a very strong analysis for why we're in this situation. You know, why we're getting this news. It's not that the people who are journalists have, like, bad ethics or bad morals or bad DNA or anything like that. It's not that the owners of our media are especially rapacious people. I mean, if Rupert Murdoch and Sumner Redstone and Mel Karmazin and that whole crowd, each and every one of them was sent off to Utah and put in the witness protection program, and you know, changed their names and got big bongs and got loaded all day long. We never heard from them again. They disappeared from the face of the earth as far as we were concerned. The companies they own would still be operating exactly the same way. The people running them would be following the exact same cues, doing the same thing, maybe not as effectively. But it's a systematic problem we face, and it's a deep-seated one, and it's historical. And what I'm proud of in this book is we spend a couple chapters going through this evolution from the period of the founders, really to the present day, how our journalism has evolved, and the complexity. And there's, to be frank, it is a complex situation that explains our journalism. There isn't one button to push. It's not impossible to explain, but it is complex. The various factors that account for the situation we're in, because unless we really grasp why we're in this situation, we don't know how to change it. We don't know what to do. It just all we do is pat each other back how smart we are to see how bad it is and go home and get kicked the TV. And 3 years from now, John and I are writing another book and we're patting each other in the back again about how smart we are. But the world's going down the dumpster. It's just not acceptable. And I'd like to say that we talk about in the book three core factors explain the decrepit situation of journalism today in the United States. There are a lot of others, and I'm going to do this very quickly. You've got to buy the book to get it fleshed out. First, and of singular importance, I think you'll see instantly, and I think I'm glad to say most Americans are understanding this now more and more, the institution of professional journalism, as it developed in the United States, has some built-in problems, the way professional journalism developed in the United States. And let me explain what I mean by that. Journalism at the time of Jefferson and Madison, throughout the 19th century in this country, was stridently partisan. If you knew the politics of the owner of the newspaper, you knew the politics of the newspaper. You didn't have to wait to the editorial page. It was stridently partisan. There was no pretense of neutrality in our journalism for the first century in this country's history. And that system actually, you know, today we say, oh, that's terrible. Partisan journalism, propaganda, darkness at noon. That system actually doesn't work that badly as long as you have a lot of voices. And it's easy to start new newspapers. There's ease of entry into the market. So if you don't like the 10 newspapers in St. Louis in 1870, it's pretty easy to start the 11th one. You don't have to be a zillionaire to get it started, and you can be economically viable. The crisis of American journalism came around 100 years ago when, due to the way market economics work and the rise of advertising, we increasingly saw fewer and fewer newspapers in each community, and it became virtually impossible to start a new newspaper. The notion of a competitive market was ended. We had the era of monopolistic markets. There hasn't been a single new successful daily newspaper launched in the United States in nearly 100 years, since World War I, in an existing market. Now, some suburban place in Arizona might have got a new one because no one lived there 100 years ago. Or there might be national newspapers because there weren't satellite distribution 100 years ago. But in an existing community, not a single successful daily has been launched in nearly 100 years, despite our population doubling. And despite this being, by all accounts, one of the wealthiest, most profitable industries in the country. And this is important to understand because what this did is it made partisan journalism incredibly illegitimate in the eyes of the public. It's one thing to have partisan journalism when you have 10 different newspapers, and each of them has a different viewpoint, and if you don't like it, you can start the 11th. It's another thing to have stridently partisan journalism. If you have one or two newspapers, have stridently partisan, and if you don't like their viewpoints, you're stuck. You can't do anything about it. And that was the situation of most Americans by the early 20th century. And let me give you a hint. It wasn't random selection, if you want to know what the politics of the newspaper owners were in 1905 or 1910. They were almost uniformly what you'd expect. They had the politics of their class. They were stridently anti-labor. They were stridently conservative. And for progressives, for radicals, a significant part of our population then, this was an unacceptable situation. And it caused, we had more upheaval about media 100 years ago than we do today. We hope to get to that level again. That's our goal. There was such an uproar about the decrepit, highly partisan, corrupt journalism of that era. And professional journalism emerged as the solution to that crisis. And it was pushed by the big media publishers because they knew people didn't trust what they were pushing and they needed to have a credible product to make money. All our great journalism schools were founded in the first two decades of the 20th century, and they were founded at the behest of publishers who would go to their state legislatures and insist that the major state university have a school of journalism. In Illinois, where I teach, it's actually the only department on our campus at the University of Illinois that exists because of a law by the state legislature. The state legislature passed a law demanding that there be a department of journalism to train journalists, pushed by the local newspaper owners of Illinois 85 years ago. So professional journalism is the solution. And the idea of professional journalism is the revolutionary idea that you're going to separate the owner from the editor. And if you know the editor, the editorial function, there would be sort of the separation of church and state, the Chinese wall between them. If you read a newspaper, you wouldn't know who the owner was, or the advertisers would have no effect. because the politics of the newspaper, the story selection of the newspaper, the journalism be controlled by trained professional journalists. And it wouldn't matter if the owner's a Republican, a Democrat, a vegetarian, a socialist. That wouldn't affect it. Trained professionals would be responsible for it. So you could trust the newspapers. You could trust the journalism. And it wouldn't matter if you only had one newspaper, because even if you had five newspapers in the town, they're trained professionals. They're all going to cover it the same way, because they're going to be trained and understand what an objective news story is in their journalism schools. And why this is important for our crisis today is the way it evolved is that the first canon of professional journalism, as it evolved in the United States, was that the basis for legitimate journalism was you reported what people in power were saying, what official sources say. This wasn't true under partisan journalism. Under partisan journalism, you were responsible for your stories. You covered who you wanted to cover, what you thought was important. But that was anathema to professional journalism. You wanted to avoid controversy. So if someone in power says something, you report it. We report it, you decide. And the range of debate, then, is determined by what people in power are debating. And if people in power aren't debating something, and you're a journalist, and you try to weigh in and bring in an issue that people in power aren't debating, you're accused of being ideological, unprofessional, partisan, a hack. So it's a strong disciplinary effect to keep the range of legitimate debate in professional journalism down to what people in power are debating. If you understand that, you can start to understand a lot of how foreign policy has been covered in this country for the last 100 years, the core weaknesses of it. It's built right into the way our professional models work. Owners love that because it takes the story, the controversy story selection away. Hey, don't blame us. The president said it. You know, we report, you decide. It's also very inexpensive to do. You just plant reporters where people in power hang out and report what they say. You know, that's a very inexpensive way to do journalism. So it fits in naturally. Now, I do want to emphasize, don't think that's how professional journalism has to be. There was a major fight in this country in the 1930s when the Newspaper Guild was formed. Journalists like George Seldes, Haywood Bruin, the young I.F. Stone, argued that this is a sham professional journalism. They said, we don't want partisan journalism. We want a journalism that doesn't represent one party versus another or one viewpoint versus another. We want a journalism that represents everyone in the country outside of power vis-a-vis those in power, that holds everyone in power to the exact same standards, that doesn't allow the owners and the advertisers to have any control over the news. The journalism should be controlled by journalists who represent the interests of the people of this country. That was the vision of the Newspaper Guild when it began in the 1930s. I won't keep you in suspense. They lost that fight. But the point I'm saying is that there's no reason why the only options are partisan journalism or the sort of professional journalism we have now. Those are just two of the options. There are many others, and we can make them if we want. And principled journalists are trying to make it. Today, the great journalism we have that I think people in this room admire, that were on that IWT tape by people like Amy Goodman or Bill Moyers, is that 1930s type journalism. It's not partisan journalism. Amy Goodman didn't pull punches with the Clinton administration, neither did Bill Moyers. Everyone in power is held to the same standard. If Ralph Nader got elected, they'd be held to the same standard too. That's what quality journalism does. That's what we need, and that's the type of professional journalism, independent journalism, free society absolutely has to generate and have to, it's the rational product of its media system. So right there, the reliance on official sources is one of the core issues. But then it's interesting. You know, our professional system, which with all its weaknesses, hit its prime in the 60s and 70s. You know, the Watergate era, the era in which journalists were slaying governments, and Ralph Nader actually was a credible news source, and the consumer movement was popular. The environmental movement actually got favorable coverage. And that was the high water mark for professional journalism, with whatever weaknesses it still had. But since the early 1970s, professional journalism and journalism in general have been under sustained, relentless, nonstop attack on two fronts, two blades of scissors that have destroyed it, that have gutted it, and leave us in the situation we're in today. First has been the corporate attack. The ruthless bottom line rationalization of newsrooms to basically make these areas sources of profits for the media conglomerates that dominate our news media. This means getting rid of foreign reporters. The number of foreign reporters has been lowered dramatically in the last 20 years. We have far fewer today covering the world than we did 20 years ago or 25 years ago. It means eliminating investigative journalism for the most part. We have very little investigative journalism left in this country. And you can see why. To the corporate owners that own our media, investigative journalism is anathema. It takes high-quality journalists weeks, maybe months, to break an investigative story. You know, what if they work for 3 months and don't break anything? You have nothing to show for it. The same journalist, or much cheaper, less lower-paid journalist, could be reporting on Natalie Holloway, or Winona Ryder's latest drug bust, facelift, shoplifting. Okay, shoplifting. I'm sorry, John's on top of the news better than I am. But, you know, they could be filling up the news hall with stories about the new yogurt stand opening in the mall, or the latest, you know, bus crash in Zimbabwe when they get the video shipped over through the video service. And it's a much more rational use of spaces. So, you know, investigative journalism makes no sense. And the worst thing about investigative journalism isn't that you don't get a story, is they might actually hit a gusher. And then you've got something that's going after people in power. And that's the last thing a media owner wants, is journalism that pisses off people in power, be it government or definitely private sector. Because that's just bad for business. That's bad. So we've seen an extraordinarily softening of news standards under corporate and commercial auspices, so that Natalie Holloway on credible news is actually considered a legitimate news story. I teach a class at the University of Illinois right now. And in this class, I've got almost 300 undergraduates. And the University of Illinois, it's our Berkeley, so to speak, in the state of Illinois. You've got to be in the top 5 or 10% of your high school class to get admitted. These are kids who are supposed to be really into media. And what I'm going to say is depressing. And I'm among friends to help. I don't want this to get back to Illinois, what I'm about to say. But I did a survey in my class. I said, okay, how many of you, this is like 3 weeks ago I did this, have heard of Natalie Holloway? And every hand shot up. I mean, yeah, Natalie Holloway. Wow. And I said, how many of you heard of the Downing Street memo? And like 6 hands went up. 6 hands. You know, Arianna Huffington did one of those Nexus searches of news coverage of Natalie Holloway's situation in the Downing Street memo in May and June of this year when both stories were hitting. And the ratio, it's in the book, but the ratio was like 70 to 1 in the number of stories on the nightly news, on the major networks, and the cable TV news networks between the two. It's extraordinary. And that fits naturally with the new corporate model of journalism. That's the dream story, Natalie Holloway. Cheap, easy to cover, absolutely meaningless and trivial, but it gives the illusion of excitement without threatening anyone in power. So that's one blade, the corporate attack. And boy, has it been a sharp blade. The other blade is just as important, though, and that's the right-wing attack on the so-called liberal media. It has been, for the last 30 years, it's been an incessant, well-funded, well-guided, and extraordinarily successful attack, this right-wing attack. And I don't use the term conservative because I think it's an inaccurate use of the term conservative. The current right-wingers, of which the Bush administration and Cheney are clearly, you know, patron saints at this point, have nothing to do with traditional conservatism except in one point. They agree in one thing that the traditional conservatives agreed on, which is that property should rule everything and inequality is quite okay. Traditional conservatives believe that. Bush and Cheney agree with that. But traditional conservatives also believe that you shouldn't have budget deficits. Traditional conservatives also were opposed to all sorts of military interventions around the world. They were the ones who were actually, hey, none of this military stuff. They didn't like that idea. But traditional conservatives didn't like big government. They didn't like corruption in government. They didn't like spying on individual rights. Traditional conservatives liked individual liberties. That's why Barry Goldwater virtually left the Republican Party by the end of his life. These guys aren't traditional conservatives except in that one point. So they're right-wingers. They're hardcore right-wingers, militant right-wingers. And this movement's a militant right-wing move against the so-called liberal media. And the point of this campaign, which is made through these think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and Cato, which is made through their right-wing media like the Washington Times, which is a subsidized paper by the Moonies to push right-wing ideas, Fox Media, Sinclair, Weekly Standard of Rupert Murdoch. The whole idea is basically to do two things, to make traditional journalists as wimpy as possible so they will have a double standard. They'll treat the right with kid gloves and be scared to death to be too hard on the right, and they'll have no such compunction towards the left. And the left here, I mean just the liberal edge of mainstream opinion. The left is, you know, that's like Neptune, as they say. That's like not even on the map. Because in the right-wing opinion, the different, you know, there's really not that much difference between Joe Biden and Hugo Chavez. I mean, they're basically all wackos. So they just lump them all together. But this campaign of the political right has been exceptionally successful. The right-wing controls the news cycle in this country today. It's why the sort of stories that George Bush sort of Teflons away barely affect him would have been enough easily to bring down a Clinton or Gore or Kerry administration. There are countless ones. We go through some in the book. I mean, this is sort of stuff that's almost so self-evident, I don't even have to give you examples, but I'll give you one, just that's recent. Imagine, now they're on the heels of the plane story, imagine if James Carville, during the Clinton administration, and Al Gore's chief of staff, I don't even know who that was. Who was that, John? It's the first time you haven't been on another question like that. That's amazing. Imagine if Al Gore's chief of staff and James Carville, in 1996 or 1997, outed a CIA agent, a top secret CIA agent, who's doing work, critical work, during a time of war, doing critical work on the cause of the war. Imagine Rush Limbaugh's response. Imagine Sean Hannity's response. I mean, the question that Clinton would be impeached, that's a given. I mean, if he got impeached over a blowjob, what's going to happen if he actually did something serious? That would be a given. The only issue would be, like, is he going to be by firing squad or hanging or lethal injection? Really, I'm not joking. That would be the range of debate on that issue. But for this situation, that's the measure of the double standard. And that didn't exist 30 years ago. That didn't exist. It exists today, and it's a direct result of this policy. Now, this corporate attack on journalism and this right-wing attack on journalism are independent of each other, but they work together. They're high, because they're both about eliminating the ability of journalism to be an independent democratic force, limiting the autonomy of journalists from the politics and dictates of owners and people in political power. And it's been, together, they've been very successful. They've been highly successful. We write about it at length in the book. And that's, you know, so it's a complex series of factors that leave us with this entirely gutted journalism. And then what do we do about it? And that's the other section of this book I'm especially proud of, which is the last section, where we talk about, you know, what we as citizens, what we as people living in this country and people around the world indeed can do and are doing to change this system so we aren't having the same conversation in 5 years. We aren't having the same conversation in 10 years. And here I've got to say that, you know, John and I, when we wrote our first couple pamphlets on this issue, we would say, theoretically, this is an issue of great concern. People ought to be concerned with it. But, you know, right now it's not really much of an issue, but it ought to be. We said, if you think about the importance of it and you look at how people are responding, this is something that ought to grasp people's attention. But, you know, you look at the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which fundamentally changed the media laws in this country. And when it was being debated and crafted, it was barely covered in our news media at all. In fact, 99% of Americans had no idea what was going on until after it was passed. There was one story in the news, and then it drifted from view, even though it did much to destroy our media system. And based on that, it looked pretty grim. I mean, how are we possibly ever going to make an issue out of who controls this media system and how it works and with what effect? It seemed fairly hopeless. Then finally in 2002, just 3 years ago, in fact, I mean, and right now that seems like three centuries ago with what's happened in the last 3 years. Just 3 years ago at this time, the Federal Communications Commission announced it was going to review its media ownership rules, the crucial rules it has that limit the amount of media single companies could own, and understand why these rules are so important. Because our media system's built not on the free market, it has nothing to do with the free market. All our largest media firms exist because they get government monopoly licenses of cable systems, to satellite systems, to radio and TV channels. They don't pay for these at all. They get them for free. They're government monopoly privileges. These aren't free markets. You have to get one of these government monopoly privileges to even get into the business. Winning that, once you win that monopoly privilege, you can't lose money, basically. So the government has strict limits on how many government monopoly licenses a single company can have, understandably. We don't want one company owning all the radio and TV licenses in the country, all the stations, or all the cable systems. And we don't want them to take the profits from these government-granted monopoly licenses and buy up all the newspapers and film studios and magazines and build up media empires. It's been understood that's antithetical to a free society, to democracy. So the FCC was going to, the Federal Communications Commission was told by the Telecom Act of 96, it had to review all these existing media ownership rules that limited the number of these government monopoly licenses a single firm could have, and consider whether it needed them anymore. Now, John and I were very depressed when this was first announced 3 years ago. In fact, I think we wrote a piece in The Nation or in These Times saying, it's over, guys, it's hopeless, the fix is in. I mean, you had the Republicans controlled the House and Senate. They had a majority in the FCC, and they were strongly in favor of getting rid of these media ownership rules. They were in the pocket of industry. I mean, the Bush administration isn't in the pocket of industry. It's in the underpants of industry. I mean, it's totally, it lives, it identifies entirely with the Sinclairs, Clear Channels, Tribunes, Viacoms. Making them happy is mission critical for the Bush administration. It's absolutely central for reasons that are politically, I think, obvious, as well as economically obvious. And they made it clear they want to get rid of these rules because they're friends in the media that delivered them the 2000 election, that have been delivering them all the good news. Rupert Murdoch made it clear he wanted to get bigger and bigger, have less competition. We thought there was no prayer. John and I were depressed. And we started Free Press at that time. And frankly, when we started Free Press, we thought, well, we're going to have to start in. We probably won't even get off the ground until after this has been settled, and we're just going to have to go on, you know, once the media system's totally a monopoly and take it from there. And then one of those great things that make me glad that I'm alive took place, it should make us all glad. So we realize, again, history can never be predicted, ever. And we saw the massive uprising of 2003. Media lines played a central role in it, organizing the hearing in the Bay Area. That was one of the great hearings that drove that movement. Local groups around the country were instrumental in making that happen. 3 million people contacted the FCC or Congress during the course of 2003, said no to media consolidation. It's an extraordinary story. And when the courts finally threw out the FCC's plan to relax the rules in the summer of 2004, it specifically cited the massive uprising of the people of this country. It said, the FCC, you were supposed to listen to the people when you made the rules changes. Clearly, you ignored them entirely. This is a joke, what you've done. Go back and start again. This is unacceptable. That's what we did through organizing. But that was just the start. I mean, we're just getting warmed up. This movement is exploding right now. And in the last part of this book, I think we provide our view of like how this movement's taken off, the components of it. It's a rich movement. It's a broad movement. I mean, it's not just about changing. I mean, on one hand, in the work that John and I do and the work that Free Press does, a lot of the work that Media Alliance does here, too, absolutely, the work they do, too, is about taking these core policies that create the media system that have been made corruptly behind closed doors to bring popular informed participation into them, knowing that the more people know about these things, the more likely it is that we're going to win. They can't get away with these corrupt policies if the public knows about them. And that's what happened in 2003. And that's a big part of the movement. But it's also stuff like IWT. It's also stuff like Pacific. It's also efforts to do independent and alternative media. That's a big part of our fight. And it's also the important educational and critique work of groups like Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and groups like David Brock's Media Matters for America, and all the media literacy workers, and all the people who work on the effects of advertising and hyper-commercialism in our society, especially on children, but not exclusively on children. This is a very broad heterogeneous movement where all the factors complement each other. It's an exciting movement, too, I think, because there's not just one issue that everything rides on. You know, remember the campaign finance movement was a hot issue about 10 or 15 years ago. If we could take the money out of politics, Stephen Hill's here, he knows that. Take the money out of politics, everything will be fine in the world. The charlatans will be exposed. The good guys will win. We'll have a great life. The problem with money in politics is worse today than ever, but that movement is crippled. And the reason why it's crippled is that if you don't win everything with campaign finance reform, you win nothing. If you leave the slightest hint of oxygen in your reform package, big money drives a Mack truck through it at 500 miles an hour and destroys whatever spirit you had in your reform proposal, to wit, our last election, which is our most money-drenched ever after all this so-called campaign finance reform. It's not that way with media reform. This has been one of the heartening things John and I and all the activists have discovered. You can win discrete victories they can't take away. We're going to have hundreds of new low-power FM stations in this country thanks to the work of people like Media Alliance and activists around this country that wouldn't exist otherwise in the next 2 years. They're coming on right now. In fact, I'm going back to Urbana, Illinois, where we're doing a barn raising with Prometheus Radio this weekend to launch our new local FM, low-power FM radio station, Radio Free Urbana, this weekend. And that only exists, we got a license to that, because of the political work we did in this country to force the FCC and Congress to give us these licenses to open up these stations. That's something they can't take away from us. We've won that. And now we say, hey, we won that. What else can we win? Maybe we can make our public access stations get the money they're entitled to by federal law, but we've got to organize and go down and do it. The work Media Alliance is doing, or over in Marin County, Peter Frank's here, forcing Comcast to deliver what they need to do to build a community media center. You can win these fights. It's extraordinarily exciting. There are also crucial fights at the national level that we can win. And I think this is a moment we're in right now where this is a social movement, much like the environmental movement was in, say, in the late 60s and early 70s. We have a window of opportunity where we're going from where. How far media reform's going to go as a movement is to be determined. It's really in our hands. I mean, we don't know. It could go very far or not very far. In the book, we talk about some of the political implications for left and progressive politics and where this fits in. But I'll leave you with two ways to think about this. On one hand, there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic, like John and I are, and we are extremely optimistic. On the other hand, though, there's reasons to be pessimistic, too. And these are the reasons to be pessimistic. The world's in real trouble. I mean, I don't think any of us, I certainly don't think I fully comprehend the disaster this war in Iraq means for all of us, environmentally, economically, socially. And the people who brought us a rock are bringing us a lot of other stuff. And thanks to our media system, I suspect I don't know about some of it. I wish I did. We have a lot of serious problems. We don't have the luxury of time. And I don't mean to sound apocalyptic, but we don't have, well, okay, we blew it this century. Maybe our great-great-grandchildren can figure it out down the road. That's not a luxury we have. We have to really get our act together. That means we have to take, we have this window of opportunity for media, but if we blow this window, I don't want to figure out, it's going to be a place we don't want to be 5-10 years from now if we don't get this thing straightened out soon. Because it's going to be awfully difficult to reform and make this a humane, egalitarian society if we don't solve this media problem as part of our social reform activism in the next few years. And that's really the challenge before us. I mean, so there's reasons for optimism that we can do it, but there's pessimism because if we don't do it, we're in deep, deep shit, really deep shit. And I'll leave you with a quote that we conclude the book with, but it's a quote that inspires me. It's a quote I leave with my students all the time when they get depressed hearing me speak all the time. And it's simply this. It's a quote that Noam Chomsky uses often, and it's inspired me, which is simply, you know, if we act like social change for the better is impossible, we guarantee it will be impossible. It's our choice. That's the choice we make when we look in the mirror every time we look at ourselves and look into our souls. That's the choice we have to make. And it's really no choice to me, and I don't think it's a choice to you. And we better get busy with media or, you know, someone else is making the choice for us. Thank you very much.
You have heard John Nichols and Robert McChesney speaking in San Francisco, California on November 10, 2005, in celebration of the release of their new book, Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sell Wars, Spin Elections, and Destroy Democracy. Media Alliance is a 29-year-old media resource and advocacy center for media workers, nonprofit organizations, and social justice activists. Their mission is excellence, ethics, diversity, and accountability in all aspects of the media in the interests of peace, justice, and social responsibility. Their website is www.media-alliance.org. Global Exchange is a membership-based international human rights organization dedicated to promoting social, economic, and environmental justice around the world. Their website is www.globalexchange.org. Independent World Television will be a nonprofit broadcast service financed by viewers across the globe. Informed by a commitment to social justice and respecting diversity of opinions, IWT News Nightly will focus on news other media ignore and suppress, and on individuals and groups that are transforming the world. You can find their website at www.iwtnews.com. New College of California is committed to education in support of a just, sacred, and sustainable world. The college cherishes intellectual freedom, the search for social justice, respect for differences, and a belief in the collective responsibility for the welfare of all people. The college is found at www.newcollege.edu. The Ruth Group is a boutique communications agency which combines sound counsel with creative solutions. They're located at www.theruthgroup.com. You have been listening to San Francisco Liberation Radio, a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week internet radio station originating from San Francisco. We are found on the net at www.liberationradio.net. Music is by Otmar Liebert from his CD Nuevo Flamenco. Otmar Liebert's work is copyrighted through the Creative Commons. Thank you for listening. This is Carmen LaSalle.